Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Andrew Shaw on behalf of the Zhang family, Leah Zhang and Vasher Zhang are presently in the gallery. I'm asking the Court to reverse the District Court's decision. It should be noted that the appellants brought a partial judgment on the two claims first, familial integrity and bodily integrity. The remaining two claims, equal protection and the conspiracy claim, to be decided by the jury. The District Court denied the partial summary judgment and granted defendant summary judgment. As brief shows, there are now material facts in dispute, as evidenced by defendant's versions of the facts compared to plaintiff's versions of the facts.
But let me suggest that just because something is disputed doesn't always mean that it's material in the sense that it affects the court's ability to grant summary judgment. So my primary question for you really is whether you think the district court made a mistake when it said, and I'm looking at page 10 of the district court's opinion, in analyzing the second prong of a qualified immunity inquiry, the court is to look to whether a reasonable official in the same position as the ones here could have believed that they satisfied the rule. And here that means could Wagner and the others have believed, Wagner, that they had probable cause and suspicion to think that the child was suffering from neglect. And in particular, they focus on his being left alone in that particular area of the living room. So it's not, was he being neglected? It's not even, was there probable cause? But could the officials have believed that there was probable cause? So do you agree that that's the correct standard?
Well, it's kind of a two-edged sword here, Your Honor. The situation is that that's not what the reality is.
Well, but that doesn't matter because our job, especially with if a qualified immunity ruling is before us, is to apply the law, and there are certainly policy reasons for the qualified immunity inquiry, and sometimes people may have done something wrong and yet they're immune from suit. But and it's obviously it's a double layer when you have the probable cause and then the qualified immunity. But are you contesting that that is the standard, whether Wagner and the others could have believed, based on the information in their possession, that they were looking at a situation of neglect?
Based on what information they have, they could not have come to that conclusion.
Now, whether they why not, given the disabilities of this child and the fairly lengthy record going all the way back to 2005, leaving a child who's disabled alone, even if it's quote-unquote just 2 hours, is inviting trouble.
But the Wisconsin statute 48.355 provides solutions for caseworkers, guidance as to how to handle. Even cases of abuse and neglect, it states that the first attempt is to try to keep the family intact. You don't just simply...
And eventually that happens. And I guess, I mean, it seems to me in the could have believed there was probable cause, which isn't even full proof, the caseworkers get the information, they speak to the sibling, the older siblings, they look into it, and from the caseworker's point of view, you're really between a rock and a hard place because you don't want to be the next person in a DeShaney kind of situation, ignoring the problems of a disabled child where things go wrong. On the other hand, you want to keep families intact, you want to work as well as you can, and so there's this middle ground which is just replete with judgment about how soon do you step in and ensure that neglect, this is not an abuse case, nobody's saying these parents abuse, it's a neglect case, and I guess I think that the district court at least is applying the right legal standard. Now how it applies to these facts is the next question, but there's a fair amount of information about reason to think that there were problems.
If the caseworkers believed what the court is suggesting, the fact that they left the one-year-old there at the home, plus the kindergarten and the eight-year-old. So if you use consistent analysis or consistent safety issue, I would think that in that particular setting, you would remove all the kids, not just simply one.
Why would you do that when it's, in fact, only the one who's removed who suffers from these extremely serious disabilities?
Because
he's in a different position, really, isn't he?
But in the context of this case, if you look at what happened, the 2 hours in a situation, a home environment, where Thor was watching television.
There's some evidence that there were other occasions as well, that there was this two-hour occasion for the birthday party, but there was up to maybe 4 or 5 times.
Well, that's heavily disputed. That's heavily disputed because what's being out of context.
But the truth of it is disputed. I understand that. But whether information was put before the caseworker that might have been the case, I think, is a different kind of question.
Well, there is nothing in the record telling the exact date or when
right.
other than the fact that it was on the birthday. That was the only time the issue regarding Thor being left home alone for 2 hours. And it should be noted that he's 12 years old. He's not a situation where we're dealing with an infant. A 12-year-old, yes, he's disabled, but at 12 years old, you have some level of personal dignity as a person.
Dr. Malone has described him as being the equivalent of a one-year-old.
Well, he's mistaken. In the record, it says he's a cognitive third grader.
Okay.
But I mean, you got to look at the context of the situation, what really happened in this case. Situation is that we have a 12-year-old. Well, this whole case.
Who can't move. He's got cerebral palsy. And so he suffers from spasticity and other conditions that go along with that. And he's not able, in this confined area, should there be, you know, a fire, should he even fall, you know, we know from the record that he falls off of things from time to time or bumps into the wall and stuff. He can't summon help when he's alone. He can't make a phone call. I mean, it's not crazy to think that this is not the right way to handle a child with those disabilities.
Well, I think the parents admit the fault in that judgment call on that particular date.
It's so never on the 24th of March 2009, Thor says that he has been left home alone, quote, lots of times.
Went lots of time, but you didn't ask the next question. Was other people there to watch you, like
no,
the three
left
grandparents?
Home alone lots of times. That's what he says. Alone means that other people aren't there.
But we just said that he has a cognitive ability of a third grader in a sense.
Well, but now, you need to be consistent here with the way you use that. You said that there was only the one time in the record. I pointed out that information, however reliable, whether true or not, I don't know, but information was given to the caseworker that this was not an isolated incident.
Well, it was an isolated incident. It's just that things got out of context. What it was is a lack of investigation. And our position is that the investigator, Michael Wagner, had an adversarial relationship with the Zhang family. And the approach, how it came down to it, it led to how it came down. The fact is that Wisconsin has protection for the family. It has protection for the caseworker. It tells caseworkers what to do when you have a situation like this.
What did the caseworker do to deviate from what you perceive, Mr. Shaw, to be the direction given by the state?
Sure. 48.355 provides that caseworkers has to try to figure out least restrictive measure to make sure that this issue of leaving the child left alone would not happen again. Situation is that Leah Zhang is a teacher. She works with kids. Vasher Zhang is a medical personnel. They're both highly educated. Plus, there's three grandparents. This one particular occasion that left alone was a bad judgment call. The fact that...
You don't dispute that Mr. Wagner made some investigation, particularly of teachers.
Even the teacher said, on the day of the investigation, Thor had injured himself. And also, there's conflicting information. That is, at the time when the initial interview of Thor, he didn't know how the bruises came to be. The referral sheet, he talks about the bruises. There's three bruises. One was the size of a quarter, one was the size of a 50-cent piece. And it's
but they're not really relying on the bruises for the decision to move him to the foster care. They're relying, that those documents suggest they're relying on the leaving him alone.
Now it should be, but if you look at their the reply, the Pelley's brief, they're trying to say it's an ongoing abuse relationship. But if you just focus on the issue, does the state or caseworker have the right to remove a child because the parent left that child alone for 2 hours? That took place a month before.
Well, I understand that, but I'm going to also throw into the mix, we have a state court finding on the 26th of March, 2009, the temporary removal is justified by probable cause. Again, not for abuse, for neglect.
Yeah, but that was under the impression it was for, quote, several hours, which is a disputed fact. Well, you know, when you tell a court commissioner, hey, this child was left for several hours, and also there's an issue whether the court commissioner or the judge knew that they left alone for 2 hours took place a month before. Whether it was immediate.
Mr. Shaw, that sounds a lot like you want us to relitigate that preliminary finding.
Actually, I want to go to litigation. That's the whole point. We haven't got to litigation.
Well, I thought there was litigation at that hearing.
No.
There was a state court proceeding, right?
My client was not represented by counsel. They just showed up and they just...
I think that's Judge Hamilton's point. The courts of Wisconsin were doing things here.
One of the other questions I just wanted to raise with you, Mr. Shaw, your brief argues a number of ways in which you believe the caseworkers failed to comply with their obligations under Wisconsin law, which has very detailed provisions for balancing these kinds of difficult questions. My question really is... whether you see any difference between the constitutional standards, the federal constitutional standards in such cases, and what state law requires.
Well, Constitution is the law. The state of Wisconsin can give more rights than the Constitution. We know that. But if you look at the Brokaw case, even the Brokaw says that if you initially move the child, it does not mean a continuing seizure. So we're dealing with the family relationship.
I understand that. I'm trying to understand whether you think all of the specifics of Wisconsin law are implied in the 14th Amendment.
I think I would say it does, but it may include more. So it's just hard to distinguish the parts.
Okay. Your claims here are federal constitutional claims.
That's correct.
Does Wisconsin law provide a damages remedy if, for example, a caseworker does not do a sufficient job of trying to use least restrictive means to prevent harm or fails to try sufficiently to reunite the family?
I believe that you can bring a state claim, but you can use the federal as well.
There's a state law claim for damages against the caseworker or against the state government?
I think you can. I believe there is.
What is it?
I believe that it's the violation of the statute.
But just because there's a statutory violation doesn't always mean there's a damages claim. Sometimes the states leave that up to the Attorney General of the state to enforce, or sometimes they leave it up to internal administrative procedures. Some states have immunity provisions for state workers in precisely these circumstances. So maybe they do, maybe they don't. But I'm saying just because the state law specifies this doesn't equal there must be a damages remedy.
I guess we're looking at, you can bring in the state claim, but you would use the federal. You basically, whenever I bring a lawsuit in the state case, I would use the federal. And use the federal as the kind of the bottom line basis, because it gives you more protection. And theoretically, it could be possible that the state statute may give a little bit more rights, may not be included in the federal. So that distinction, that little extra, maybe the state would have some remedy for. But I never brought in that in this context. This is a context where a summary judgment was given. And I'm arguing that maybe you can initially move the child for the issue about 2 hours. But the statute in Wisconsin gives you guidance for the caseworker what is being reasonable. And they should not be given qualified immunity in that context, in this case, as outlined in the briefs. So to going back to your first question,
I think you just ran out of time.
You can finish your thought.
Going back to your first question, yes, I guess that standard does exist, but you've got to be within the context of the facts. You can't just say you were led to believe, because if you use that standard all the time, then there would be no any kind of a case. Anybody can say that. But that's where the fine line is.
Thank you, Mr. Shaw.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Baskin.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Tim Bascom. I represent Marie Froh, Dan Cepeda, Michael Wagner, and Dutch Lidell in this case. We believe the trial court's ruling on summary judgment must be affirmed. To respond to Judge Wood's first question of, is the standard whether a reasonable caseworker could believe that abuse or neglect had occurred. That is exactly the standard.
And it's an objective standard, right?
Absolutely.
You look at the facts, it's not individual.
Right, and that goes to one of the areas that you talked about, and that is your perception that this is a case of neglect. And when it reached the temporary hearing, in fact, that was the assessment of the trial judge, finding that probable cause did exist to find that neglect had occurred.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was my impression from the briefs, et cetera, that this was based on the incident or incidents, I guess the number was unclear, of leaving him alone.
That's correct.
It wasn't about any bruises or photographs or anything else.
That's correct. And at that probable cause hearing, the judge... The plaintiffs were present. Thor was represented by a public defender. The state was represented by a state's attorney. And Michael Wagner from the department was there to answer whatever questions the judge had. Between the initial taking into protective custody and that hearing, the plaintiffs were interviewed by the police department in Caledonia, and Thor was seen by Dr. Malonis. And Dr. Malonis said, although he could not say that the bruising was or was not the result of abuse, he thought it was definitively a case of neglect. Based on all of that, the judge found that neglect had, in fact, occurred sufficiently to substantiate probable cause to place Thor into foster care. But getting back to the initial placing into protective custody by Mr. Wagner, the district court recognized that this is an objective standard, and it can be based on either objectively whether there is evidence that a reasonable caseworker could believe that either abuse or neglect occurred. The facts in this case are a referral was made by one of Thor's teachers to the department. The department assigned Mike Wagner the investigator. He went out and first interviewed the teachers and the administrator, who told him what they had seen and why they thought it was evidence of abuse that they felt sufficient that they had to report.
Well, they're under a statutory obligation, right? They're
absolutely
reporters, yeah.
Absolutely. And then Mike Wagner continued his investigation. He interviewed one of the siblings, who said that the father struck Thor as punishment and threw Thor on the floor in the living room. He interviewed Thor himself, and Thor confirmed both of those statements. Now,
how well is Thor able to communicate?
Not terribly well, but he did have his teachers available at the review with Mr. Wagner to assist, and Mr. Wagner asked him questions like, he talked to him, he left the room, he came back, he said, "Do you remember my name?" And Thor responded, "Mike." So Michael Wagner was convinced that he was getting at least accurate information from Thor's perspective. But interesting, what is important is Thor, in his statement about the bruising, stated to his teachers that his father and mother had caused certain bruises and told Mike Wagner that his father had thrown him on the floor. This corroborates what the brother said and could give rise to a reasonable belief by a social worker that abuse had occurred based on that referral by the mandatory reporter, the
teacher.
But
then he drops the abuse idea and eventually settles on neglect.
Exactly. But it's still, Your Honor, supports the initial taking into protective custody standing on its own. But during his investigation, he received a statement from the younger sibling, from Thor, and Thor's older sibling, that Thor was indeed left home alone, unattended, on more than one occasion, barricaded in the living room. This is a child who is severely disabled and cannot care for himself, or respond if there's a fire, or call for help. Mr. Wagner continued his investigation and went to the home and interviewed Mr. and Mrs. Zhang, and they conceded to him that they had, in fact, left this child home alone and demonstrated how he had been barricaded into the living room.
But, you know, I guess I must say one incident of perhaps very bad judgment might be an awfully high standard for most parents to achieve. And so it is a question worth asking why the department jumped to take Thor out of their custody. And I'm actually curious to know what was it that triggered their thought in the final analysis about 5 or 6 months later to return him to their custody.
Well, that was the progression of the CHIPS proceeding, Judge. And it wasn't once the looking at the initial.
So the
taking,
one mistake standard doesn't bother you? I mean,
given the substantial deficits of this child, I don't think any of us would disagree that leaving a 1-year-old or even a 5-year-old home alone, barricaded in a living room, while there are other members of the household available to watch over that child, in a situation where the child has a care worker who is in the home twice a day, and the family, according to the report by the children, the family waited until the care worker left to barricade the child in the living room. All of those facts, and the question isn't, what did Mike Wagner think? The question is, what could a reasonable social worker reach the conclusion that constitutes neglect?
Mr. Baskin, let me come at this from a slightly different angle.
Sure.
I think all of us are familiar with the idea of emergency removals in cases of abuse. I don't recall having seen a case of neglect being treated as such an emergency before that there wasn't even an effort to have a hearing. I realize our case law has kind of wavered on that question as to when and whether you need a hearing. But this seems awfully unusual.
It is an unusual case. This is an unusual circumstance. I'll concede that. But the question before the court is whether a reasonable social worker could have believed they were justified in taking the actions that they took.
Well, I don't think you want to frame the question as whether one mistake by parents justifies emergency removal without a hearing, without any opportunity to be heard.
I'm not suggesting that the court lay down a hard and fast rule that one incident would justify that. What I'm suggesting is that under the case law that existed at the time, the question is, based on the facts and circumstances that were developed in the investigation by the social worker, could a social worker have believed that placing the child in protective custody was justified by probable cause, thereby giving the social worker immunity from a private lawsuit, so to speak.
We have something a little more than a neglect case. At the outset, we have like a neglect plus case. Don't we have, so as far as framing what the case would stand for, we have a social worker who had to factor in the possibility of abuse because Dr. Molina's doesn't preclude it. So we don't have to face a situation where we're creating a rule of one mistake. This isn't leaving a child in a parking lot while you run into the supermarket for a half hour. Not that that should be approved, especially in today's environment. But in any event, we don't have that here, do we?
No, I agree completely, and as did the district court. The district court noted that we're not talking about a single act of neglect forming the sole basis for the removal of this child. It is all of the facts and circumstances. It's the fact that there were reports of abuse by a mandatory reporter that was corroborated by a sibling and by Thor himself. There were statements by more than one sibling that this child had been left home alone on multiple occasions. And it was the totality of the circumstances. You look at, could a reasonable social worker believe that probable cause exists to remove the child from the home? And then, under the Hernandez analysis, did that probable cause dissipate between the initial taking into protective custody and the time that there was the probable cause hearing? And the answer is no. As you've indicated, Dr. Malonis saw the child and said he did not say one way or the other whether or not the abuse or the bruises were caused by abuse. Unlike Hernandez, because in Hernandez we had a situation where a doctor said the breaking of that child's arm was not something that would normally be seen in an abuse case. And it was the court's decision that with information like that, probable cause dissipated. You move to the next step where there's a state court hearing in front of a judge and he's presented with the evidence and he finds that probable cause exists. Now, this is not a finding that there was actual neglect. This is not a finding that, based on all of the evidence, the parents have been found to having neglected this child. That's what the following CHIPS proceedings are all about. This is simply a finding of probable cause, that, in fact, the initial taking was appropriate, and we're going to continue the child's placement in foster care.
Was there ever a finding of actual neglect?
No, there wasn't. Okay. In fact, what happened...
Okay. I just wanted to follow up on one thing I asked Mr. Shaw as well. I don't know that it certainly doesn't directly affect the federal constitutional questions or remedies, but does Wisconsin law provide a damages remedy?
I don't believe so, Judge. There are certain obligations placed on social workers and courts and prosecutors within the context of Chapter 48, which is the Children's Code, but I don't believe it provides a remedy of money damages.
And those are obligations that I assume are supposed to be enforced by supervisors and by judges.
By judges, correct. Mm-hmm. Or by district attorneys, representatives of the state,
but
as opposed to private actors.
This wouldn't fall under a general tort claim. No. Statute would be subject to exemptions, exceptions there.
Immunity. The under Wisconsin law, state actors that have discretion are awarded immunity for claims against them for tort claims. And that really is what it comes down to in this case, is whether or not under the case law that has been developed in this circuit and in the rest of the United States, specifically the United States Supreme Court in Hunter, the question is, did Mike Wagner develop information that would have allowed a reasonable caseworker to reach the conclusion that probable cause could exist? Thank you.
Ms. Shaw, your time has expired, but you may have an additional minute.
Judge, with respect to the neglect plus abuse, that's not the facts in this case, what's going on. The situation is that when Thor got injured at Becky Collins' place and he had bruises, question was asked of Mr. Wagner, why didn't you investigate that? And he said that we know that he self-injures. So if you have the view what you're suggesting, then that's inconsistent with what the reality is. Even on the page 10 of the reply brief, he acknowledges that it wasn't about abuse.
I appreciate that, but when the teachers made the report, we don't know whether they're reporting based on neglect or abuse, do we?
No, but it started out with abuse, but you have to look at the actual size of the bruise. That's really important.
I appreciate it's so difficult to make an assessment on whether it's a self-inflicted wound or not. I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. I'm just trying to frame this as one would in the case of what Mr. Wagner faces when he receives the information.
I guess, but if you look at it from the point of view, if you just say, well, if you just did that one mistake and then the caseworkers are entitled to immunity, I think we're going down the wrong
direction. That's my parking lot example. I understand if the Wagner-type social worker is faced with a report of a neighbor seeing a child left locked in a car in the driveway for an hour. That's pretty much screams more neglect to me than abuse. But when you have injuries evident, which we don't know how they occurred, but the social worker has to factor that in with a suggestion of neglect, I see that just slightly differently.
And I would just add that, you know, you have to look at the idea, the motivation behind Wagner, the idea of manipulation, manipulate the system. I think that is a strong factor also.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.